a violent mob of insurrectionists stormed the Capitol to prevent the peaceful transfer of power to President-elect Biden. How can everyone responsible for this terrorist attack be brought to justice? Let's get on topic. Welcome to On Topic, a weekly in-depth look at a topic that helps us understand the week's news. My name's Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst. And I'm joined by my friend Patty Vasquez, the host of The Patty Vasquez Show, who joins us regularly on this podcast. But before I bring in Patty, I want to thank our patrons who brought us this episode, with special thanks to Andrew Donnelly, James Frohmeyer, Jay Gelhausen, Jamie and Izzy Gordon, Patrick, Angela Jackson, Ari Lamstein, Dan Maruska, Shana Wachinski, and an anonymous patron. You too can become a patron on our website, ontopicpodcast.com. Just click the support link at the top of the page. So, Patty, I have to say, I don't even know how to begin this podcast. It was not even a week ago, we recorded a podcast talking about Trump's pressure campaign on the Georgia Secretary of State. We knew that January 6th would be a big day. It was clear that Trump was trying to rile up his followers and supporters regarding that. But I didn't expect this. And I have to say, I was literally brought to tears this morning watching the officers getting beaten by a mob of white supremacist Trump supporters who wanted to kill the vice president, the Speaker of the House, and other elected officials, essentially engage in a violent overthrow or takeover of our government.
Renato, I was on the phone, I think about a week or so before this happened, and I was talking to a former state senator, and we were talking about how we believe people were going to die. And I had tweeted a little bit about it. I was there were a lot of counter protests in D.C. and in various places around the country. And I just tweeted out, look, just don't even try. Let them run rabid, wild, and let law enforcement do their jobs as safely as possible. Renato, to be honest with you, this was not exactly. I mean, I we were at the point where this could have been much, much worse. It was catastrophic, I believe, in many ways. But this was what I thought. And I had a discussion this morning with a friend of mine who's a Republican, and I've been having, a lot of them are, really trying to come to grips with what they have believed and held on to for so long. There are a lot of people who still to the last minute or continue to believe that as long as they get their policies and their agenda through, Trump was still their candidate because he represented that. But we've been trying to tell them for years, you have this huge base of white nationalists and who ultimately were capable of doing what they did on Wednesday. And what I've told you every week, I think for I don't know how long, Renato, is what we have been, really needy for, I guess is the best way to desiring is accountability and justice. And for anyone to say now that we have to unite with terrorists, that we have to unite with fascists, that we should just move on, I'm not here for that. And I don't care, people are saying that it sounds inflammatory. Well, you can't have your foot on our neck and expect us to just keep lying there. Anyway, I'm sorry, Renato. I feel a lot of responsibility today because you have a lot of listeners who have a lot of questions, and I want to try to get to as many of them as possible.
Well, and we will. We're not going to cut this short. One thing I will just say to our listeners, Michael Zeldin felt so strongly about this topic that he reached out to me and asked to be on the podcast to discuss this topic. Wow. And answer questions. So that's why he's our guest this week, just to preview that. But no, look, we'll record this for as long as it takes. But I will just say, Patty, you mentioned the problem of white nationalism, and I kind of two minds about this. I mean, on the one hand, yes, it was shocking to see the images of these racist, white supremacist pieces of crap in our nation's capital, waving the Confederate battle flag, which is a symbol of the Ku Klux Klan, adopted by a Forrest, you know, when he was leading the Ku Klux Klan, a symbol of white supremacy and hatred, and a lot of them displaying, whether it's through signs or through their statements, you know, racism, white supremacy, etc. And there's no question that that has been an element of the Trump coalition. But I have to say, I feel like this attack went beyond that. In other words, it's easy to say, okay, there's these white supremacists over here, and they are violent, and they're terrorists, and they're evil. And they are. I agree with all that. But what Trump managed to do is convince the base of the Republican Party that he won by a landslide. The election was stolen from him. And these people were in there, some of them not white supremacists, some of them people who were convinced that they needed to hang Mike Pence by a gallows that they had erected outside of the Capitol in order to prevent him from stealing the election from Donald Trump. There's a whole level of craziness and insanity and evil. I don't know how you get beyond I'm not saying it's more evil than white supremacy, but a whole different vein of evil that was part of this as well.
But there is complicit behavior because they've allowed the white nationalists to hijack so much of what they pretend to aspire to, which is, you know, freedom and liberty and always wrapping themselves in the flag. And that's what I mean, though, is, you know, when we look at Colin Kaepernick kneeling, silent demonstration of, we are suffering. People of color are suffering. Black men are suffering. And people who would tell you, you know, just scream until they're red in the face, I'm not a racist, but I don't think it's okay. You know, that's disrespectful. People die. But it was at its core, even those who would say they are not white nationalists got wrapped up in that. And it became very easy to continue every single step of the way to go along with, you know, and President Trump saying, you know, take him off of the field on a stretcher. And, you know, all the name calling, they, you know, allowed themselves to be hijacked by those who made it worse. Yes, were there people who just thought that it was an unfair election? Because as the professor from Harvard or Yale, I can't remember his name, said, if you tell big lies enough times where your followers feel inspired to go and attack our Capitol to beat people with the American flag. When you mentioned the police officer who we're now seeing video of him being attacked, they're at one point using the American flag to beat him with that pole. Then I don't understand how people are surprised that we're calling them fascists. They are.
Yeah, I hear you. I will also say, too, I mean, there is, you know, you're saying a complicity with white nationalism. There's a complicity with this QAnon garbage, which is, you know, essentially they believe that all the Democrats are child molesters and there's some secret cabal or whatever their bizarre beliefs are, totally tolerated, promoted by many of Trump's close allies like General Flynn and others. You know, but let's be real here. The complicity in this is not just Donald Trump. It's 100-plus members of the House who joined this bogus lawsuit in Texas trying to get the election overturned. You know, 100-plus House members and certain members of the Senate like Hawley and Cruz who were spreading lies about the election and, you know, doing this bogus decertification or, you know, trying to block the certification, this whole effort. You know, there are many, many, many Republicans. I would say the only Republican that I would give some credit to on this would be someone like Mitt Romney, who voted to remove him from office, because I think that's an action, not a word. Like, that's a legitimately he did something. So I'll give him that. But so many of these people encouraged Donald Trump, benefited from Donald Trump, would say, oh, I didn't read his tweet today. Oh, I don't follow his tweets. I don't know what he's saying. I don't know what he's doing. His words have consequences. And if you're not reading his tweet, Congressman, there are millions of people who are and are becoming radicalized. I know some of them. I've seen some of them with my own eyes, I'll tell you. And here we are seeing them. Here they are in their full splendor and glory, marching into our Capitol and defiling it and scaring the crap out of people and almost killing more people than ended up dying here. In other words, it would have not, in my mind, been out of the question for members of Congress to have perished in this attack. It was very fortunate. The bravery of one, there was actually one black Capitol police officer who led the mob away from the Senate chamber, for example. Unbelievable bravery. One man against an army to lead them away. So I just think that, you know, I have to say that, you know, to me, this is what has been wrought. And what I see from, what I see from the Republicans is they're like Pontius Pilate from the Bible, right? Who washes his hands in a basin to, you know, the blood is not on my hands. And that's what I think a lot of the Republicans are doing right now.
Oh, no doubt about it. And so swiftly turning it back on liberals and the idea that if we pursue justice, then we are, you know, that basically the next time they attack, it'll be our fault. And it always has been. If Antifa and BLM hadn't stood up for injustice, this wouldn't have happened. It's all the left's fault.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, for a while, for like a few hours, Patty, they were trying to convince us that the people with the Trump flags screaming and trying to attack Nancy Pelosi and defile her office were Antifa. Give me a break. I mean, that requires this level of Orwellian, like Soviet Union level BS it's almost a level of chutzpah, right? They even try to convince us of that BS.
But Bernardo, it wasn't for the first few hours. You know, for the first day when I was started, I mean, you know, I needed to express whatever I could and outrage. And also, you know, aware that, I'm not necessarily somebody that people, you know, consider a leader, but I have a following that I'm very, I understand the role of making sure that they know that they're not alone. That's what I try to do, that their rage isn't, you know, because we're also isolated too. We have nowhere to go. We're in our homes. So, you know, sometimes we look to the people we admire to see, you know, how are they feeling about this? What's their take? And for the first day or two, you know, it was hard for me to find my legs, but it was mostly rage. And there was no pushback from any of the crazies, none of the conservatives, or any of the people that generally pop their heads up and the whataboutism and everything. But after about a day, Renato, I'm still getting people who are saying it's Antifa and BLM that were, you know, had infiltrated, that were part of this, that were the real instigators of this. And so that wasn't just the first few hours. That is continuing. And I'm, you know, I also, just to change a little bit of the direction, I also, you know, these videos of Lindsey Graham being yelled at in the airport and the Trump supporters flying home, planes almost having to be rediverted because they were causing, you know, chaos on the flights. You know, this is, I really am one of the people that thinks this is really just going to get worse in different ways. I don't think something like at the Capitol level, but I'm really concerned about the next few weeks and, quite frankly, the next few years.
Yeah, I am concerned about the future course of American history. You know, we've talked a lot, I think, about the radicalization of the Trump base really since his defeat. I think that's a topic we've discussed multiple occasions, this disinformation campaign and so on. I don't know, you know, what's really going on here. I don't know what's going to happen with the Trump base now with, you know, if he, you know, he's leaving office, he's blocked on Twitter and every other social media platform. Parler's getting shut down. You have all these radicalized people who believe all sorts of falsehoods, millions of them still out there, and they're looking for somewhere to go. And what I hope is they don't go to somebody who is as evil as Donald Trump, but much more competent. I mean, if I had to say what my fear is that a Hawley-type person actually gets some measure of control as a successor of this crew, because somebody who's really savvy could do more evil with them and with their support than Trump ever did. And that's my fear.
Okay. And I think there will be a lot of people that are drawn to that message because the infrastructure for the delivery system for those messages has been there since at least the 1960s. You know, when you have this consolidation of media and we're not just talking about Fox News, we're talking about radio stations where, you know, for a lot of rural areas, that's their source of information. whether it's, you know, because the same station that delivers your sermons, your mass, your daily, you know, religious message is also intertwined with, and I always say this as somebody, not only as a former talk show host on traditional radio, but also somebody who's traveled across the country as a comedian. I used to spend about 40 weeks out of the year. And, you know, I would be in places like North Dakota, South Dakota. I would talk about being Mexican on stage and like have people after the show in the 90s yelling at me about how my people are taking jobs away from local workers.
Yeah.
So this is not, we're not, this isn't spontaneously erupt under Trump. He took hold of the reins and really drove this into the ground. And now that, you know, they emboldened, as we've talked about for the last 4 years. And I don't think that this is going to be an easy path forward for anyone.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, hate and racism and all of these forces have been, you know, these evil forces have been there for a long time. I feel like technology has helped bring these people together, right? If you're if you're some racist in a small town, you know, you may not find all the other racists around the country. I think that Trump helped, I wouldn't say legitimize these people, but make them feel like they could show their faces, right? Like Charlottesville and so forth. He, you know, I think he also brought together these folks with the traditional Republican sources of information and made it so that some of this stuff was getting amplified in traditional Republican outlets and which drew people who are traditionally part of the Republican base to this garbage. And so, you know, I will say it's what is really needed right now. And I got to tell you, I've had so many conversations since this attack with members of Congress, with Democratic, you know, activists and people who are head of different groups. I mean, it's been a constant source of conversation about what should we do and so forth. And I've got to say that my take on it, and I'm glad that there will at least be an impeachment vote, although we can come to what's going to happen after that. I do believe that that every Republican member of Congress needs to be on the record here. Do you stand with Trump still or not? And I want that vote. I want people now to be in a situation where they are going to have to be on the record repudiating this man. Because we need to divorce him from the Republican Party, because that party needs to be rid of this the cancer that is Donald Trump.
I don't have faith that they will in enough numbers to really make a difference. I have no faith in the GOP. I don't. They have benefited from this, and you mentioned Charlottesville. That should have been the line. And they kept moving the line. Well, you know, again, lowering the bar for liberty, for democracy. They kept doing it, and here we are. They stepped right over it.
Yeah, I mean, no question. I mean, any bar. I mean, it was interesting to see, of course, for example, you know, folks like Senator Toomey now condemning Trump and having his comments thrown back at him all the times where he was saying that, I didn't see this tweet. Oh, I didn't, you know, whatever. All the stuff that he was doing. I mean, many of the Republicans denounced Trump as a demagogue and as unfit for office, even before things like the Access Hollywood tape or Charlottesville or the travel ban or other things, separating children from their parents, a subject that's just, you could tell it sticks in my craw because I bring it up quite a bit. I just think it's so evil. So they were there for all of it and stood by this guy. So it's very, very hard for them to off-ramp now. But let me bring in, I got to bring in our guest, Michael Zeldin. I knew Michael, we're a legal analyst together in CNN. You've probably seen him on TV at some point or another. He held all sorts of senior positions in the Justice Department, including being the chief of the Money Laundering and Asset Forfeiture Office. But he also has dealt with violent crime as well. He was also independent counsel during the Clinton presidency for a matter. And then he also had been deputy chief counsel to the U.S. House of Representatives as well. So he's had various levels of experience that I think make him a great guest for this topic. And like I said earlier, he volunteered to join us today, and I was happy to have his voice as part of this discussion. So let's bring in Michael Zeldin. Welcome to the podcast, Michael. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So I have to say, Michael, Patty and I have been venting a little bit over the past few minutes. I want to give you an opportunity to tell us your reaction to this violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol.
Well, it was just that, Renato. It was a violent insurrection that was pre-planned by the rioters long before they arrived in Washington. They were ginned up by Don Jr. and Giuliani, and then ultimately the president. And they arrived at the Capitol with what was their pre-intention to storm it. And unfortunately for the Capitol and the people who lost their lives most particularly, the police were not there in adequate force, and they were able to overrun them and do what they did. It was a disaster on all constitutional grounds, all criminal law grounds, and most particularly policing grounds.
Yeah, I have to say, you know, we're going to talk a lot about legal liability here, and I'm certainly happy to do that. I've been fielding an insane number of questions on this topic over the last few days. But it seems to me that there's something more profound that happened here, which is that this was a day where there was it was part of the process of the peaceful transfer of power in this country. And really, for the first time in this nation's history, we had the outgoing president try not just through even legal means, but through illegal means. He was trying to incite others, I think, to try to put pressure to prevent the peaceful transfer of power. And we have these folks, you know, obviously they were deceived by Trump and his allies to believe that the election had been stolen, but their intention was, through some of them, through murder and other forms of violence, to prevent the transfer of power to the next president.
There's no question about that. They were there to prevent the ouster, in their estimation, of the properly elected Donald Trump. And they came there armed and ready to effect their will. And it was no different in some sense than 1812, when the British invaded Washington and burned the Capitol. This was an outside force that attacked the Capitol. It was, Renato, in my estimation, what would have been like had Confederate troops broken through and arrived in Washington, something that they were endeavoring to do throughout the entire Civil War, with thankfully no success. But that's what it was. It was an external force, essentially, endeavoring to undo an election. And I don't like to use words like coup and other things like that, but to keep in power someone who was lawfully unelected or lost the election. It's stunning. Really, it's stunning.
Yeah, it is. It will be a chapter remembered in American history. I mean, I find it, you know, I find it to be more disturbing, more problematic than other attacks we've had in this country that have garnered similar reaction. In other words, we've all lived through the 9/11 attack, for example, which we had obviously a foreign terrorist group attack symbols of our nation, like the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, obviously generated a massive reaction by the United States, united the country against them. Ultimately, we decimated that foreign terrorist organization and killed its leader. And here we have domestic terrorists who, in my estimation, did something far worse, because here they weren't just seeking to destroy. It's not like they blew up a room of the, or, you know, planted a bomb, although they did plant bombs in the DNC and RNC headquarters. But in addition to that, they were literally storming the Capitol in order to try to overturn our government and to disrupt the activities of the United States government. To me, this merits an even stronger response, and I think it will be remembered in history as a very dark moment for the United States.
Yeah, I agree with that, and I think that I said it a moment ago, and I'll say it again. It reminds me of the Civil War in respect of, you have a duly constituted government, which was the Union, and then you had this secession government, the Confederacy, and the secession government was trying to essentially undo the duly elected Union government, and they were fighting to achieve that. And I see that very similar here, especially when you see those who were in the mob that attacked the Capitol wearing Confederate flags and carrying Confederate flags and all sorts of anti-Semitic and other racist things. This was sort of a second civil war in some respect. And it brings us in some sense to, so what do you do? You know, you've had this attack by this mob, and now you have to figure out how to hold them accountable. And there are a lot of different ways that we can talk about, and you'll ask the questions, but they have to be held accountable. Every one of them, the inciters and the perpetrators and the enablers.
Well, and that, I think, is a really good overview of what we have to talk about today here, because I think there are different, in terms of legal liability, there are going to be very different, those are very different categories. Inciting violence is a more challenging legal theory than actually bringing a case against someone who committed violence. Before we do that, I know Patty has some, there's all sorts of questions about this topic, Michael, that are even go beyond legal liability. Patty, you had a question from one of our listeners.
Right, because, you know, before we get into the legal aspect of this, of course, you know, we're talking about that this was pre-planned, as you mentioned, and, you know, many are saying that it wasn't. There are a lot of people who are going to say this wasn't pre-planned, this was just, you know, the momentum or the energy, they got carried away. But if it was not a pre-planned coup, then why did 10 secretaries of defense send out that letter in the days leading up to the 6th? There seemed to be the sense that Trump was going to do more, or perhaps they did know. I mean, we're speculating, of course.
No. And anyone who says that this was a spontaneous uprising is deceiving themselves. There were, if you followed the conversations on the internet among these people, you'll see that they are engaged in domestic terrorist conversations. And in fact, organizations like the Anti-Defamation League and others who follow domestic terrorism were all sending letters of warning to government officials saying there's an insurrection coming. They're planning it. And when they got here, you can tell that they had pre-planned it because they were carrying walkie-talkies. They were organized. They had cells, leaders. It wasn't, you know, a completely top-down command and control structured organization, but there were surely components of it, Proud Boys and others, that were well-organized and had pre-intention to do what they did. So anyone who thinks that this was just the spur of the moment is wrong. But if they were just the spur of the moment, then the question becomes, how can a peace-loving crowd like this get so riled up? And if the answer to it is they were riled up by the speakers, then they imply that those speakers should have criminal liability for inciting a riot. So which way do they want to have it? They either were peace-loving people who were incited by Don Jr. and Giuliani and the president, who then will be held accountable for inciting, or they were pre-existing criminals who carried out a well-executed plan, or maybe both.
Yeah, I have to say, I also find it absurd, this idea that this was not pre-planned. You literally had people there, you know, the terrorists there with, like, restraints to, like, to essentially a form of temporary handcuffs. Like, they were, like, there to take hostages. You don't just bring that to a protest. I've been to plenty of protests. It's not like you go to the Women's March with your restraints and your, you know, body armor and so forth. I mean, these people were clearly ready for some sort of confrontation.
That's right. And they even had, it was reported locally here on the, by the law enforcement authorities, they had maps of the tunnels in the Capitol. So they were aware of how people move within the Capitol, and they were going to execute, I think, members of Congress if they could get their hands on them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's crazy how close that came. I mean, I'm you know, there's the video of literally one of the Capitol police officers leading the mob away from the Senate chamber, just in, kind of baiting them to go the wrong direction. I mean, they were very close, within a minute, of getting some of the members of Congress and senators and so forth. And God only knows what would have happened.
Exactly. And if you look at how the Capitol police officer who died, how he was murdered, do you know how what I read was that he was beaten with a fire extinguisher. So they beat a Capitol police officer to death. That group of people had malice in their heart and an intent to do that, which they did to that poor 42-year-old police officer, unto others, is my sincere belief. Which is why, Renato, when we get to the criminal law part of it, there should be sort of no mercy for any of these people.
Well, yeah, you're not going to get any argument for me. I will say, yeah, this is, you know, I think a lot of people have been surprised. A lot of the civilians out there have been surprised by how foolish this group was. It doesn't surprise me. I've prosecuted many foolish criminals in my day. And, you know, there's a lot of people already who are being prosecuted. And I have to say, everyone who's part of this episode, I suspect, is going to face a very stiff penalty. They're going to get convictions and a stiff penalty unless there's some evidentiary problem.
Exactly. And, you know, it makes me smile when you said you prosecuted a lot of stupid people. When I was a prosecutor, we used to always say, when a defense attorney would walk into the office and say, well, you know, my client, you would you presume him to be that stupid? And I said, look, if stupidity were a crime, I would add that as an additional count in my indictment.
Yeah, I've prosecuted. I don't want to get into all the stories, but I've prosecuted some really foolish people. But, you know, that's certainly what we have here. But one thing I will say is, of course, that the comedic element of some of these people does not detract from the evil in which they perpetrated. And I think maybe I think a good starting point, Michael, is we use these words, insurrection, and people have used the word sedition and things like that. Can you help explain what some of these terms that people are throwing around about this, what they mean?
Sure. So there are a batch of statutes, which I'll call like sort of the political crimes of this. If you look at the events, there are sort of property offenses, the destruction of property category offenses, then the disorder category offenses, the remaining on a federal building disorder. And then there are what I'm calling the, and what you just asked about was the what I call the political offenses, sedition, insurrection, domestic terrorism, inciting a riot. All of those statutes more or less boil down to whether or not the individual or in the sedition conspiracy, a group of individuals had an intent to interfere with the functions of the government, the lawful functioning of the government. In the sedition conspiracy statute, it says two or more people agree to delay the execution of any law of the United States by force or hindrance thereof, contrary to legal authority. In the rebellion statute, it says whoever incites, sets foot, or assists in any rebellion or insurrection against the United States or the laws thereof. The domestic terrorism defines someone who is engaged in activity that is intended to influence or intimidate the workings of the United States government. So all of these laws, Renato, involve a criminal intent to interfere with the functioning, lawful functioning of our government. And there's no question but that the perpetrators of the event may well have violated these statutes by conspiring to illegally interfere with the counting of the votes for the certification of the election. Where it's a little bit more complicated, and I'm not completely convinced that the statutes are that easily applied on the evidence that we presently have, and the evidence is still coming in. Make no mistake that there is still stuff to be gathered through the internet about who said what to whom and how it was acted upon. But in respect to President Trump, his son, Michael Flynn, Giuliani, all of the speakers at the March to Save America, that was the march name of that they came down for before they stormed the Capitol. Those, the application of these statutes to them would require that they incited, essentially, or conspired with those criminal mob elements to do this. And inciting and seditious conspiracy is complicated because in the context of political speech, there's a First Amendment aspect to it. And so if you think about this, here is an egregious situation of the president and his allies yelling to a crowd of people that the election has been stolen, that they should go down to Capitol Hill and essentially protest their grievance. The one thing that we have to remember is that Trump did say in that speech that he says, "I know everyone here will soon be marching to the Capitol building to peacefully and patriotically make their voices heard." Now, he talks a lot about fighting for their rights and, you know, being strong and showing strength, but there is this peacefully and patriotically having their voices be heard aspect of it, which, you know, is a little bit complicating. So you have this First Amendment part of this, and one looks at these types of laws, inciting and sedition, one has to remember how they've been used in the past and why they're so dangerous and why liberals and progressives should be very careful before they say, we want the expanded use of these statutes because we dislike Trump so much. Remember, these were the statutes that were used against the Chicago 7 in their anti-war protests in Chicago. These were the statutes that were used against Eugene Debs and the socialists as they protested the draft in World War I. These are statutes that are used against environmental activists, against the Puerto Rican nationalists, against civil rights leaders, because many who were in power at the time of those insurrections or those protests, I shouldn't say insurrections, I take that word back, those proper protests were thought to be creating a clear and present danger to the United States, and they were charged with crimes for doing that. So you have to be careful, I think, to not let these statutes get too widely used, because they'll get used against you sooner or later.
Yeah, and I guess – so what I would say is it's a great overview, I think, of some of the issues here. I mean, just if I was going to break down the categories for people so everyone understands, you know, people who – there's a lot of folks who just did things that are very straightforward here. In other words, if you killed someone or you're involved in killing someone, you don't need me to tell you that, you know, you could be charged with murder or some lesser form of that type of crime. If you stole government property, it's not going to surprise you that there's a statute that criminalizes theft of government property. Okay, it's one I've charged many times. You know, trespassing is a misdemeanor, just even being there. I looked up, because I was looking up statutes, I got asked by so many publications this week about what people could be charged. There's a statute that criminalizes entering federal government property with the intent to disrupt the lawful functioning of the government.
Yep, exactly right. I represented an individual when I was a defense attorney, Beachy Wright. People can read the United States versus Beachy Wright decision. Beachy went into the Capitol, into the crypt of the Capitol, that's the lower part of it, and destroyed a glass encased model of the Capitol because God told him to do it. And they charge him with the destruction of property and improper entry and the like. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not, there's very straightforward crimes that don't implicate speech, that all of those people that are there that were actually setting foot inside the Capitol as part of this insurrection can be charged with. So as those people get identified, I think they're going to get charged. That'd be my prediction. They're going to get charged with straightforward crimes like that because they're just straightforward to prove. And there's those people were clearly there to disrupt the lawful functioning of the government. I don't think any juror would conclude otherwise. And it's if you can prove they're there, I think they're all gonna get convicted in statutes like that.
Yeah, and you know, and especially easy will be the weapons statutes, all the interstate transportation of a firearm, possession of a firearm without a license. All those things are basic blocking and tackling for federal and state prosecutors, because there'll be both federal and state charges that are possibly available to prosecutors around the country.
That's a great point, Michael. And one thing that folks should understand is, you know, you're used to, you've been listening to this podcast for a while. You're used to me talking about how hard it is to prove someone's intent and knowledge and how can we read their mind and so forth. The easy thing about these sort of statutes is you don't need that. In other words, Exhibit A is the defendant. He's here. You slap an exhibit sticker on this guy's forehead. He walked into the Capitol. That's it. Or he was arrested with this gun, or here's his video of him with the gun. That's it. He didn't have a license for the firearm. It's very straightforward. You don't need to prove a lot of times anything more than just what they did, which makes these statutes very straightforward.
Right. They're status crimes, essentially. You are, as you just exactly said, if you're in the Capitol without authority to be there, if you remain in the Capitol without authority to be there, you committed a crime. If you possess a gun without a lawful intent, a license to do that, no intention is an aspect of that crime. It's just, did he or didn't he?
Yeah. So I think a lot of these folks can get charged with stuff like that. And I think prosecutors will do that. And then judges, just so everyone understands, federal judges can take into account all of the nature and circumstances of the offense when they pronounce the sentence. So in other words, somebody who had entered into the Capitol because they wanted to protest Supreme Court justice or something, that's one thing. Somebody who's entering the Capitol because they want to hang Mike Pence by the gallows or whatever is a totally different thing. And a judge is going to be able to consider that difference and take that into account during the sentencing phase.
That's right. And in fact, what really offended me in the aftermath of the riot is, you know, Ari Fleischer did some tweets, as did some of the other members of Congress, trying to sort of equate, for example, the marches, the Women's March and the He's Not Our President inaugural march, as if those were somehow equivalent to this mob. You know, as I said, I take back that word that I used earlier. There are lawful protests that you and I and many have been part of. And that's what the First Amendment protects. And then there are mobs who engage in criminal behavior. And that's what we saw in the March to Save America.
Mm-hmm. And let me, I know Patty's got a couple questions from our listeners. Why don't you give us one of those, Patty? And those are good questions.
Absolutely. So, you know, you just mentioned if somebody was inside the building and you can prove the intent of why they were there. But people have a lot of questions because of how massive the crowd was on the outside. Did those who amassed on the Capitol steps and scaled the outside of the building but perhaps didn't go inside, did they also break the law? And are there any efforts to identify and charge them?
They probably did break the law. I expect that it is not lawful to scale the walls of the Capitol, and I expect in the process of doing that, there's provable damage that was done to those walls. I mean, they're going to scuff them if at a minimum, and they're going to probably chip them in other respects. So I think that the fact that you're outside doesn't insulate you from responsibility under the criminal laws. Those who are inside and, you know, using barricades to break down windows, those are going to be charged with more serious crimes than those who are outside. But make no mistake, the area around the Capitol and really around America these days, is under constant surveillance. There are cameras everywhere, and I expect that the FBI are combing through that video footage, and they're identifying people, and they're going around, and they're going to arrest them. I think this may be the largest manhunt in the history of the Department of Justice, to find all of those people who were there, who violated the laws of the United States.
So this plays into that as far as the damage on the property of the Capitol. You know, as we know, President Trump over the summer, in response to the fights for injustices across the country, signed an executive order, the Statues and Monuments executive order. How will that come into play?
I was going to say, here's the funny thing about that. You know, Trump kept tweeting about, oh, everyone's going to get 10 years in prison for defacing our statues and monuments. All he was doing was citing an existing federal statute that was already on the books and carries a penalty of up to 10 years. And it's one of the statutes along the lines that I was mentioning. In other words, if you enter federal property or have any, you know, if you, you know, do anything to federal property, that can be a felony offense. If you knowingly damage federal property, or if you're entering to disrupt the government. So that's all that is. And he made a big deal about it when it came to taking a statue down, because of course that was a dog whistle to these folks who loved Confederate generals, which he spent a lot of energy on. We know why these people love Confederate generals, because they were traitors who betrayed our country to promote white supremacy. But in any event, you know, that's all that was. So yeah, the problem for these folks is that, unlike a random person who toppled a statue, there's no sympathetic argument you could make to a jury or to a judge in sentencing. And there's going to be a lot of energy, as Michael just mentioned, around identifying and prosecuting these folks. So we've kind of talked about all the people inside, and I kind of feel like our listeners by now are like, yeah, we know all those people are going to prison. What we care about, what we want to know is, what about all these other folks? And so I'll kind of break down into a couple of buckets of people, right, who we're talking about. I mean, on the one hand, there are organizer-planner people. In other words, we don't know who they are, okay? Whether it could be Rudy Giuliani or Lynn Wood or Sidney Powell could have been involved, or it could just be a lot of people whose names we don't know. But people who were not walking into the Capitol, but nonetheless were coordinating this behind the scenes in some way. I think that's one category of people. And then, of course, I think that group of people, there is a fairly clear path to criminal liability, and I'll let you explain your thoughts on it before you go into mine, Michael. But then I think there's the other group, which is the people who are cheering from the sidelines and perhaps encouraging from the sidelines. And, you know, there's incitement can go into that bucket as well. I think that, as you were kind of alluding to earlier, Michael, that's the more challenging one, because the First Amendment in this country offers such broad protections to speech. So maybe let's talk about that first category first. What about the people who weren't there? Maybe they didn't even come to D.C., but they were, you know, Giuliani might have been on a cell phone coordinating pieces of this or something like that.
Okay, so Giuliani, of course, was there, and he gave a speech that was famous for the line that he said, "We're going to have trial by combat." That was his line. And so if you're going to be looking at, do any of the speakers at the rally have criminal liability? Giuliani, Don Jr. and Michael Flynn gave, you know, sort of the most incendiary speeches. But let's break down that broad category that you just outlined into sort of two subcategories. There are the people who may not have shown up at the rally, but who were, I'll call them, in the command and control arm of this, those who were organizing the people who were going to go to Washington. So there can be people who are part of, we called it a sedition conspiracy. You could be part of a conspiracy without having shown up at the event. Like you and I conspire, the three of us, Patty, you and I can conspire to rob a bank. And we all meet, we have a meeting of the minds that we're going to rob the bank. And we take the first step in furtherance of that. We buy a car. As it turns out, I can't make it down to the bank that day. So you and Patty go down there and you rob the bank, and everyone is apprehended. All three of us would be charged with conspiracy to rob that bank. The fact that I didn't make it down there is not relevant to whether or not I was part of a conspiracy to rob a bank. And so if they don't show up at the rally, it doesn't insulate them from criminal liability if they were part of a conspiracy to engage in this in this criminal behavior. And so those are, I think, also pretty straightforward legal cases. They're not simple legal cases. Conspiracy is never as simple as possession of a gun. But those are people who I think can be charged. The hardest group are the people who are just in this category that we're talking about, the people who were the inciters, those who gave the speeches in front of the White House and told the crowd to essentially to go down to the Capitol building. Those are the hardest, I think, for me, the hardest category of people to bring criminal charges against, because you have to show an intent to incite them to do violence, and then there is the First Amendment right to speech, and you have a right to incendiary speech. You know, thankfully, in a sense, if you look at some of the speeches in the anti-war movement days, my youth, or in the civil rights days, there were some pretty incendiary speeches and good incendiary speeches. It's the John Lewis of good trouble. There are good incendiary speeches where people have to get riled up for criminal justice and equality and other just causes. And you wouldn't want a situation where those people, as they were chargeable with inciting. So that's the problem here. We have to be very careful, as I said earlier, in not applying laws and setting precedent in the application of laws simply because we don't like the actors, because those laws, if they become sort of normalized in their use, will ultimately become used against your friends. And I'm very, very hesitant to give broad, expansive reading to sedition and incitement statutes, because I know how they have been used, and I'm fearful how they will be used.
Yeah. So to go back to that first group, I do think, as you point out, there's some very easy, I don't say easy, but there are straightforward applications of the law to charge them, and I think that's an important group, because who knows? I mean, Giuliani was there, but we don't know what he's saying on the phone. For all we know, he's there literally coordinating people walking in, go toe to this chamber or that chamber. We don't know. There certainly could very well be people who were involved in a more coordinating, directing mode. Conspiracy is one way. Now, as you point out, Michael, more complicated than proving whether or not somebody entered a property or whether you had a gun or something, because you have to prove state of mind. Once again, is you have to prove, did the person intend to be part of this effort? But let's say if somebody's, got direct messages or instant messages or text messages, or there's testimony or other things that show phone calls, phone records that show coordination with the people who are in the Capitol. That could be very powerful evidence that could prove conspiracy. And then there's also aiding and abetting. I think that's important as well. One thing, by the way, for conspiracy, you actually have to know what's going on. In other words, people who just were trying to coordinate, let's say, a protest, aren't really going to be held, can't be criminally held responsible for something that ensues unless they knew that something along those lines was going to happen. In other words, if they knew that the group was going to enter the Capitol, then a conspiracy to unlawfully enter government property, for example, could be charged. But if they didn't know that, if they thought everyone was going to remain outside, then that's a different story. But also, as I mentioned, aiding and abetting, all you need for aiding and abetting is to know to know about the criminal activity and to help make it succeed in some way. So if you knew that these folks were going to be entering the Capitol and trying to disrupt the certification of the electoral votes, and you were giving them car rides or financing. I know there's been some questions about, for example, some conservative organizations. I know Justice Thomas's wife was involved in one, allegedly. There's been some reports of that about, busing, paying for people to get bused down there. All of that's possibly chargeable if the people knew at the time that a particular federal statute was going to be violated by the individuals that they were aiding. So I think that's important.
That's right. And in addition to aiding and abetting, there are lots of sort of accessory after the fact. There are lots of ways people can sort of join in to criminal liability if they weren't sort of there on day one. I mean, you don't have to have been part of mine and Patty and your conspiracy to rob the bank from day one. You can join that conspiracy later on. You guys in the bank robbing the bank, and somebody says, "Hey, let me help. I will. I know how to open the safe. I can do that." Then that person is has joined the conspiracy, and they weren't there from the beginning, but they have aided and abetted or become an accessory to it, or a secondary co-conspirator. And so there are lots of different ways prosecutors have to broaden the scope of who faces criminal liability for the acts inside and outside of the Capitol.
Yeah. And then as to get to that last group, which I think that's very important, this idea of incitement. So I do agree with you, Michael. It, just so everyone understands, there's this actually is, been a big subject of important legal decisions before the United States Supreme Court. There's a famous one from the 60s. I think it may have been 68, Brandenburg versus Ohio. And essentially, the Supreme Court held that unless you're trying to incite imminent lawless action, incitement to violence, essentially imminent violent lawless action, then it's protected First Amendment speech. So I can, give some speech and say, these people are evil and they need to be dealt with, or, vague terms like that. But unless you're trying to get people to enter the Capitol to hang Mike Pence, for example, that's different. But of course, there were people doing the latter, and you can see them on video where they're like, "Let's go in there and make these people pay." Well, those people are clearly, that's not going to be protected speech. Those are more the director organizer types that we talked about earlier. But the issue is people who were giving a speech an hour earlier talking about, a bunch of lies about the election getting stolen, those are going to be in the problematic category.
That's right, because the Brandenburg decision, and Brandenburg, remember, Brandenburg was a Klansman who said some horrible things in that speech, and was convicted under a state statute, and the ACLU took the case to the Supreme Court and won on the argument that the First Amendment protects that sort of speech, absent a call to, if you're on the podium and you're giving a speech and you point to somebody in the crowd and you say, kill him, hang him, lynch him, whatever, something like that, or attack, 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 then that moves from politically protected speech to an incitement to cause harm. And the closer in time the speech is to the illegal act, the easier it is to try to prove causation, that the words cause the deed. The further they are away from it, the more difficult it is to say that those words were words that incited the lawlessness.
That's right. It's really the term that's used, I think, in the Supreme Court decision is imminent. It has to be very soon thereafter. One thing I do want to say, though, which is important, is there right now is our draft articles of impeachment that have been circulating. And the one count is incitement to insurrection. And I will just say that these discussions that we're having don't really preclude an impeachment in this ground, although I, certainly the Trump's defenders, I know Alan Dershowitz, in fact, was citing Brandenburg and so forth. So they'll use those arguments that this is protected First Amendment speech by Trump. But I don't really think that's going to preclude an impeachment, which is not strictly legal. It's really a political exercise by Congress.
Yeah. So let's talk about impeachment, because it's you know, going to be the flavor of the day this coming week. If we remember the first impeachment, there was a discussion about whether or not there has to be underlying criminal conduct for there to be an article of impeachment. Dershowitz, in that in his defense in the impeachment number one, we'll call it, argued that for conduct to be impeachable, for it to be a high crime and misdemeanor under the Constitution, it essentially requires an underlying crime. He was in a minority in that point of view, but he adheres to the point of view that there has to be an underlying crime for there to be a valid impeachable offense. Here he would say, I expect he will say, that because the language that Trump used was First Amendment protected, you cannot bring a criminal charge of sedition or in inciting a riot or some domestic terrorism. And therefore, you find yourself in the same situation as you found yourself the first time around, which is impeaching someone for conduct which is not criminal in its nature. And I think that will be the nature of his defense. And I think it is... a minority view that it has to be a crime for it to be impeachable, but we will see that play out. But you're absolutely right, Renato, to say that when you look at the draft article of impeachment that's floating around, the conduct which they're charging him, and there are two things which we can still talk about. The first one is that he willfully made statements that encouraged and foreseeably resulted, meaning he had the intent, he willfully made statements that encouraged and was foreseeable that encouraged imminent lawless action at the Capitol. So he made willful statements that encouraged imminent lawless action at the Capitol. So those are the Brandenburg words, that he is making statements that encourages imminent, as you pointed out properly, imminent, immediate lawlessness. That's what they are charging him with. Dershowitz will say, yeah, but you can't charge him with a crime because it's First Amendment, you can't impeach him for it. That's where the legal debate is gonna lie in the trial in the Senate. But there's nothing that prevents the House from bringing an article of impeachment alleging it, because remember we said all along throughout the impeachment part one that an article of impeachment is essentially an indictment. It's just a charge. The House charges that Donald Trump willfully made statements that encouraged imminent lawless action. Now, the other thing that's interesting, and we haven't yet talked about it, is that in the draft article of impeachment here, there is the whole other, you know, set of behaviors that relate to Trump's phone calls to the Georgia Secretary of State to find enough votes to overturn the Georgia presidential election results. And his threat to the Secretary of State, Raffensperger, criminal threat that if he failed to do so. So there's this whole other thing on the political side of this, unrelated to the Capitol, which is the president's phone call on January 2nd to the Georgia Secretary of State saying essentially, find me votes to overturn this election. And there is a statute that makes that a crime. You cannot interfere with the right of citizens of a state to have a fair and honest election. And so there's a whole second set of behaviors that the president engaged in that find their way into this draft article of impeachment, and which also could be freestanding as a criminal offense. There is a statute your listeners can look it up. 52, they just Google 52 USC 20511. And it's a criminal offense that makes it a crime to attempt to deprive the residents of a state of a fair and impartially conducted election. And so Trump stands the prospect of being impeached for two things, the Capitol and the Georgia call. And then he also stands the possibility of being charged on the Georgia call alone. And there is no real First Amendment overlay to complicate that charge.
Yeah, I think that's a great analysis. I will just say more broadly about the issue of impeachment. Dershowitz has already made this the argument. He's already said it. He hasn't even formally been isn't formally representing Trump, but he's already making this argument publicly. I'll just say I think it's a bogus argument, and I think you're kind to say it's a minority view. If you look at prior impeachments, whether it's Nixon or Clinton, the House of different political parties have brought charges that are not solely in the criminal code, abuse of power and so forth, and have alleged things that you could not charge in a courtroom in both instances. And the founders, when they created the provision of impeachment, were considering, frankly, I think something things akin to this, like a president who's trying to unlawfully stay in power or, you know, in league with a foreign government or something like that, that wouldn't necessarily fit the four corners of a statute. But it's clearly the case, it seems to me, very hard for me to for there to be a originalist argument that the criminal code as it exists in 2021 governs what is impeachable or what's not impeachable. I find that to be a bogus argument. And from my perspective, I also would say that, you know, as you point out, Representative Raskin and the others who are working on this article of impeachment were wise enough to anticipate the Brandenburg versus Ohio point and literally parrot the lines from this test, so that the real question would be, I mean, if it was speech that incited imminent lawless action, then it meets the Brandenburg test. It's not protected political speech. So really, there's going to be a factual argument. Ultimately, Dershowitz's argument boils down to arguing, well, it wasn't quite imminent or wasn't quite incitement or whatever. Essentially, he's arguing, making factual arguments about what Trump did or what resulted from it. And, you know, I don't know how compelling that's going to be to a jury of senators or not. I think they're going to be more focused on their own political considerations as they were last time.
Yeah, but let me just say one thing about Dershowitz, which is Alan is a true civil libertarian. He believes, as the ACLU does, in protecting First Amendment rights as broadly as possible. And he has a sincere belief, which I share in large measure, that people should not be charged with crime for making First Amendment protected speech. He fits into the category of sort of Justice William O. Douglas and others who believed essentially in an absolute First Amendment right of speech. And so he comes to this from a long tradition of sort of American Civil Liberties Union styled First Amendment sincere beliefs. So, you know, one should be careful. I'm not saying at all that you said this, Renato, but I know he's going to be pilloried out there on the internet and elsewhere. But one has to understand that he comes to this from the standpoint of he would defend, because he believes in the First Amendment sincerely, he would defend the right of people to march in Skokie. He would believe in the right of Brandenburg, the Ku Klux Klanmen, to give that speech in Ohio. He believes in that right of free speech. And he doesn't have to like who the person is that's giving the speech. And I'll tell you, he doesn't like Trump. He wouldn't like Brandenburg. He certainly wouldn't like the Skokie marchers, but he will fight for their right to speak. So I don't feel like I need to defend Alan Dershowitz. He is quite capable of defending himself, but I just want people to understand that that's the perspective from which he comes. He personally comes to this conversation.
Well, I got
to
say, Michael, I disagree with you to an extent on that. I agree with you that there are many people who shared the perspective you just said. I wouldn't be surprised if the ACLU takes the position that you just said. In other words, that they're going to defend Trump, you know, defend Trump on the issue of incitement because they care about the First Amendment. They care about the precedent it's going to set and so forth. And I have no doubt about your sincere beliefs. But I have personal experience with Alan Dershowitz. I've interacted with him repeatedly throughout the Trump era. And I've become convinced that he is willfully deceiving the public. He often makes statements about the law that are deliberately deceiving. And I think I have not been able to discern a common direction for them that indicates to me any kind of true belief other than a belief to get attention for himself. And he does appear. I mean, he told me privately he regretted voting for Obama. And I don't know whether he dislikes Trump or not. Let's just put it that way. I don't know what his views are towards Trump. I'm not going to put anything into his mind. But I feel confident saying that I think he doesn't believe everything he's been saying publicly. And I think some of the arguments he's made, I mean, he would attack Bob Mueller for things like saying that Mueller was impaneling a grand jury in D.C. to try to influence the jury pool, which is absurd. He was doing that because the venue was in D.C. He was saying things that he knows better, in my opinion. And I just find him at times not to be an honest player. That's my view on it.
I was just only talking about the sincerity of his belief in the First Amendment. I'm not talking about all Mueller and other things. And
may I ask a question about the sincerity of both your and Dershowitz's commitment to the First Amendment? The intention of which, my understanding is, you know, in the document is, you know, in response to the total way of governing from the British Empire, right? So if it then is being used to protect those who are trying to be fascist, to be authoritarian, you know, what kind of protections do we all then have?
Well, it's a complicated, you know, sort of philosophical question to say, I want to be able to limit the speech that I think is dangerous and allow the speech that I think isn't. And you ask yourself the question, who gets to arbitrate that? Who gets to decide what's good speech and what's bad speech? And I can say, as a person who considers themselves a political progressive, I can say that people in power have used bad speech arguments to prosecute people who are progressive way more than they've used it to prosecute people who weren't. And so I'm just, you know, not able to, you know, sort of accept that broad use of these statutes. I'd rather let the sort of the free marketplace of ideas, let them, you know, sort of get their soapbox and let them talk on Twitter or elsewhere, and let the weight of their arguments carry the day or sink them.
I also just I wanted to react to that, Patty, what you said as well, is that one thing I find what you're mentioning, Patty, I mean, your view is part of a big debate in First Amendment law. And in other words, about hate speech in particular. If you're giving speech that's espousing hate towards a particular group, there have been laws that have been passed to ban hate speech. And there's a lot of debate legally over the constitutionality of those laws and where you should be able to draw the lines. Because obviously, if you have groups that have been subjugated, have been discriminated against, that have had systems that have been constructed to disadvantage them, and they speech that targets them has an impact that really undermines other pillars of our democracy. And yet we have the First Amendment, which the courts have read super broadly to give a lot of protection to speech in a way that other countries don't have. Okay, in Germany, you can't use a swastika, for example. But in the UK, they don't have that level of protection for speech. But we have that here. So this is a big debate that has existed for decades. I learned about it when I was in law school 20-some years ago, and it still rages onward.
Yeah, and it's not simple, and there isn't a right or a wrong answer. It depends on just sort of your view of society. Listen, there was in everyone knows of this notion of you can't yell fire in a crowded movie theater. That is just too much. That it creates a clear and present danger, and therefore it's not protected speech. So where did that concept come from? How did it come to be that Holmes, I think it was, who fashioned it, come up with it? Well, my recollection is, and Renato, correct me if I'm wrong, or your listeners will correct us if we're wrong. My recollection of it is that they jailed the socialist Eugene Debs for a speech he made in Ohio, Canton, Ohio, where he said, where he spoke against the draft in World War I. He said, essentially, if you want us to go fight your wars, give us the vote to determine whether we want to fight in this war. He was arrested and convicted, and his case went to the Supreme Court. And in upholding his conviction for that speech in Canton, Ohio, the court said his speaking against the draft created this clear and present danger, that it was akin to yelling fire in a crowded movie theater. Well, if that's the context in which it found its origin, then I'm not real happy with that concept, because Eugene Debs was giving a speech against the draft in World War I, a speech that he had every right to give. And if that's criminal because someone in government believes that it created a clear and present danger to the orderly function of our government, then God help us if that's something that we want to countenance.
Okay, if I just one more thing, and I know I could do this all day with both of you, is so then even if the result is something like what happened on January 6th?
Well, the argument would be the result would be a prosecuted, right? But I think you're right. I mean, I think the danger is there. In other words, Patty, we have all these white nationalists in the United States. They're basically equivalent to the skinhead neo-Nazis that are banned in Germany. Those people are not allowed to march with their swastikas in Germany. They're not allowed to espouse certain views in Germany. They can be imprisoned merely for espousing the ideas. In the United States, you can't be imprisoned merely for espousing the idea. If you're a bunch of Nazis in Skokie, that was the reason that Michael chose that was a very famous legal case. The ACLU defended them. You can march with your hoods and your swastikas and so forth. But once you violate some criminal statute for doing something, then we prosecute you at that point. It's not necessarily the right balance. No one's saying that it is. That's the constitutional balance, or that's where it has been in the courts. And that's why that's the most fraught piece of it. So, I by the way, for me, I am not endorsing any of this in terms of here's how this is the Renato crafting of the First Amendment law. I'm just telling you here's how it works, and you can get mad at the United States Supreme Court, not at me, because I'm not on it.
That's right, but you will be. I expect you will.
Oh, gee, okay.
You're still young enough. But I think that's a great point to make, which is, what we're trying to set forth here is the arguments that we will see play out over the course of the coming weeks and months as we analyze the behavior of Trump and the insiders and the what the prosecutors like to call the alligators, the one who actually are doing the criminal behavior. And the last group that we really haven't spoken about in terms of what, if any, political consequences should there be? And that's for those senators who sort of essentially gave comfort to the enemy, in my estimation, on the floor of the Senate, Hawley and Cruz in particular. And I think that those guys, that there's no place in the Senate for those two men, that their behavior in essentially encouraging or at least accepting, encouraging in Hawley's place and at least at a minimum accepting in Cruz's place should disqualify them. And the Senate, if it had any sort of moral compass, would seek to disqualify them from service.
Patty, I know we have a lot of questions. Why do you fire some of the, we have so many listener questions. Let's just Just start feeding them to us because I know there's a lot.
So, but let me just say, Patty, we're in the first hour of our 3 hour conversation, right?
I know. I apologize to any listeners who really wanted to have their question asked. I'm doing my best because this obviously people are they have concerns, they have questions, and they've been scared for a long time, and they want accountability and justice, which they feel has not been at all within our reach over the last 4 years. So let me start
and,
with.
And so they Renato is, you know, experienced an experienced user of social media. I go to his Twitter page all the time to learn stuff, and I see with good reason he's got hundreds of thousands of followers. I, who have abhorred Twitter and avoided it at all cost, have decided that maybe I should use it. So I think in the last 2 weeks I did this at Michael Zeldin. I have I think now 300 followers, which I think are mostly my family.
Let me make sure I'm following you.
No, but the point is that I'm happy, as I'm sure Renato is, because that's what he's been doing for years, to have people follow me and send me questions, and I'll try to answer them that way too.
I'll send you a document of all the ones I didn't get to.
Okay, so it's just at Michael Zeldin. I'll try my best to live up to the great tradition that Renato has set for me.
There you go. If you don't hear it here, go ahead and tweet at Michael. So we have Michael Zeldin. I have a few. So if the House gets impeachment underway per the Constitution, are pardons then not allowed in cases of impeachment? Obviously, there are a lot of pardoning questions coming up too.
Right. So there's so many things to talk about. The power of a pardon does not apply to impeachment. You cannot pardon an impeached person. You can pardon other things, but not impeachment. That's one of the exclusions from the presidential powers of pardon.
Okay. And can Trump pardon the seditious rioters who attempted the insurrection?
Yes. Mm-hmm. He can.
All the more reason to get him out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Well, right. But that's right. I mean, if he really wanted to give the middle finger, as they say, to the country in his last hour of his presidency, he could pardon every single person that was arrested at the Capitol could be arrested at the Capitol.
So for the timeline on that, then, is there any, you know, should people then withhold the charges, continue the investigation, and then file charges after he has, because the pardon is only for crimes already charged, right?
Well, no, you can pardon for future crimes. So that's what happened with Nixon. Nixon was never charged and Ford pardoned him. So yeah, no, definitely. You know, the thing though is he has to identify the people. So Trump can't just pardon everybody who was there without knowing their names. Now, this was actually something when the draft Dodger pardons from Jimmy Carter, it came up. They actually had a commission like find everybody, get a list of names, so that this way it wasn't just, you know, a general pardon, so to speak. So that would be the only limitation I could think of.
Well, but let me just add one thing, because I don't disagree with you mostly. The pardon was intended, in my estimation, when it was put into the Constitution, to pardon people who were convicted of crimes and have shown a repentant side since them. That's sort of what the pardon office in the Justice Department does. It looks at people who were charged with crimes and now deserve a pardon or having their sentence commuted because the sentence was so long. Renato says, and it's understood to be correct, that you can pardon somebody prospectively, I can't pardon someone for a crime that they haven't yet committed. But in the case of Ford, he pardoned Nixon, who was not yet charged with a crime, but was believed to have engaged in criminal behavior. So the Ford pardon stands for the proposition that you don't have to be formally charged with a crime. You just have to have done something that's criminal. The thing that that's mostly correct, but why it may not be entirely correct, not because Renato or I are making a mistake, but nobody ever challenged the legality of the Ford pardon. They just accepted it and let it be. And so no court has ruled, to my knowledge, of the legality of this preemptive pardon. And so if Trump were to preemptively pardon somebody, and a prosecutor said, you know what, I don't believe you have that power, then it would go to court, and then we'd get a legal ruling on whether or not that's lawful. But until such time, because Ford did it to Nixon, we assume sort of the lawfulness of it. Do I have that right, Renato?
Yeah, I agree 100% with that. And, you know, listeners might remember, if you haven't listened to this episode, a few episodes back, we had a professor who studied and written about pardons, a law professor, and she talked about it. And I think that was sort of similarly where we came out. I think she thought it was lawful, but she noted it hadn't been tested by the courts. And who knows? It's possible that he might not be able to.
And leave it to Donald to give us the opportunity to find out. Some are also talking about Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. Can you expound on that?
Sure. That is a section that enables Congress to expel members who are involved in rebellion against the United States government. The 14th Amendment was one of those amendments that was passed after the United States Civil War. And the purpose of it was to keep out Confederate leaders who, what they didn't want to have happen was a bunch of Confederate leaders to get, elected to the United States Senate and so forth, and essentially have influence or potentially take over the government with their treasonous ways after the Civil War. And there's been some talk about using that to expel folks now. And I will just say I'm not an expert on that section of the 14th Amendment, because frankly, it's never been used. It's not something that people typically study or discuss, but that's what it is. I don't expect it to be used. And I say this partly just from because I, basically, from everything I've seen and heard, including my discussions with several members, I think it's hard enough to get the House and the Senate to just proceed normally with this impeachment, and there's been talk of delay and so forth. I don't see them taking a more extraordinary step, which would be to expel members.
And in fact, in follow-up of that, I think there have only been 15 members, 15 senators expelled by the Senate, and I think 14 of them were for seceding from the Union and going over to fight with the Confederacy.
Well, wasn't that with Lincoln, where they would not recognize the results as well for his election?
Well, and they got expelled. They got expelled because they seceded from the Union, which, ironically, allowed the Congress of 1861 to 1865 to be probably the most progressive Congress in the history of the United States, because all of those guys were not there to object. Exactly. When they all came back after Reconstruction, they started objecting again, and we haven't had a progressive Congress since.
Could you explain to people who don't understand that the party of Lincoln was progressive and not? Okay, anyway, that's another podcast. Go ahead, Renato. Sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say that sounds about right. I will just say that in that circumstance, though, these are folks who literally not only didn't recognize that Lincoln was the president, but they took up arms against the United States and rebelled and so forth. Here, Hawley and Cruz made procedural objections that they trumpeted on social media as some sort of grand gesture that was going to change anything. But no one, under the rules, it was never going to change anything. And they had a right to make those objections under Senate rules. So it's not like they did something that by the book was improper in and of itself in the very narrow sense. That's part of the process that's outlined in the Senate rules and so forth. So they were just exercising their authority within the Senate rules. So I think it's just unlikely to happen for a variety of reasons.
Right. Whereas Hawley may have, he's from Missouri, so I don't know what the electorate of Missouri, and it'll be up to them ultimately to decide. But remember, it was Hawley who is famously photographed with a clenched fist in front of the Capitol sort of encouraging those who would later come in and destroy the Capitol Hill. He will say in his defense, I was just, you know, sort of raising my fist in their right to be out there and protest with no anticipation that they would storm the Capitol. And so if I knew that, I would have never put my fist out there. But again, I think you have to have been an ostrich to not know why these people were coming and what their intentions were, because it was, as they say, hidden in plain view all over the internet about why they were, who they were, and why they were coming, and what their intention was.
And speaking of in plain view, a lot of folks have questions about Fox News. And is there any sort of legal recourse when it comes to Fox's role in spreading so much of this hatred and vitriol?
I don't think so. I think that they're a broadcaster. They're broadcasting the information, just like I don't think there is. You remember what Trump was trying to get rid of in this Section 230 debate? The fact that the Twitters and the Facebooks and all these other platforms are protected from liability for that which is posted on their platform. Trump hates that because he's going to go to war with these guys in the remaining days of his presidency. I think similarly that the cable networks and the on-air networks, they are most likely protected. I don't know, Renato, if you can think of a circumstance where they would have liability.
Yeah. So, well, I'll just say a couple of things. First of all, on the flip side of it, I will also just mention that I agree with the general thrust of what you said, Michael, and that also applies to the Twitters and the Amazons of the world who are shutting down Trump's speech and the speech of his followers. In other words, you have no right to speak on a private platform, and they can select whatever speech they want. I think the only thing I would say is that I could potentially imagine some defamation suits or other types of suits along those lines, like we've seen from Dominion voting systems and so forth. You could potentially see that's one of the exceptions, you know, potential exceptions to the First Amendment, but not really regarding, you know, incitement or anything along those lines. They're just a platform that's providing people, whether it's Trump or any of his followers, to spread their views. And under the First Amendment, they have a right to do that.
That's right. But you're right to say, and I didn't understand Patty's question to be asking about civil lawsuit. But there is, as you exactly say, Renato, there is a possibility if someone says something that's defamatory, whether it's a host of a show or a guest on a show, they said something defamatory. The fact that they said it on a TV show doesn't insulate them from civil defamation liability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of conversation, and this again, another podcast, most likely for somebody else, is about the role it seems that some amongst the Capitol Police might have played. Now, we're all going off of video and our own interpretation, but if any of them are shown to have played a role, what is the likelihood of prosecution for officers who open the gates or wave them in? Would federal prosecutors at least consider?
Well, that's hard. You know, if you're going to charge a Capitol Police officer with moving a barricade so people can come in, I think the police officer is going to have, you know, a viable defense as to what he was doing it for. For example, if his thought was, I've seen these mobsters down the hallway picking up these barricades and smashing people with it, my intention was to get that barricade out of their reach so they couldn't use it as a weapon. That's one category of, you know, sort of police officer. But if there's, I think, proof, and I don't think there will be, but I think there's proof that any of the Capitol Police officers conspired, going back to that word, with any of these mobsters that came in, then there could be conspiratorial liability. I just don't think you're going to find it. I think the biggest thing that we talked about it a little bit, and we can come back and have part two of this thing, is how in the world did it ever come to pass that there were inadequate police and barrier protections to keep this group at, you know, at arm's reach from the Capitol building?
Yeah, I think I have a similar reaction. I mean, what I would say, too, is I think another defense that would come up would be duress. In other words, the only reason I did what I did, like get out of their way and let them in, is because there's a mob of 100 plus people and they were going to kill me or hurt me in some way if I didn't. And so I think that would, you know, if you're talking about a sort of a criminal penalty. Now, some of them might face discipline or might lose their jobs or whatever. I don't know. You know, those are really far afield from my expertise. But I will say, separate and apart from all of that, you know, there has been some suggestion, most notably by Jim Clyburn. You know, Jim Clyburn believes that it may be possible that there was an inside element to this job, because he, you know, he mentioned that protesters knew where his private workspace was, and they went there instead of where his nameplate was. And Clyburn's convinced that they had inside information. Now, if there was somebody in the inside actively helping, as Michael said, you know, that's going to be like the example of the co-conspirators from earlier. The fact that they were on the inside, is going to enhance their penalties, not hurt them.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one thing that bears emphasis in analyzing the liability of President Trump in the inciting of a riot and trying to figure out what his intent was and all that stuff. What is interesting to me is you see the video. I think it's the Lincoln Project that has a videotape of Trump and Don Jr. and Chief of Staff Meadows and a woman who I didn't recognize watching the mobsters in the Capitol. And it takes 2 hours before Trump decides to stop it. And how does he stop it? He sends out, it's like a video link where he says, "It's time to go home now. You're special people. I love you." Now, you know, of course, when the Black Lives Matter protesters were marching, he said, "When the looting begins, the shooting begins." And in this case, he's saying, "I love you. Go home," 2 hours after it starts. Now, one might, add that as evidence of a state of mind and intent that he intended this to happen. He facilitated its going on by delaying his response. And then there's a lot of conversation out there about how the D.C. government and Maryland government and Virginia government were all asking permission of Homeland Security to be able to send in troops to stop this. And it took a long time before they got permission, because you can't send in the National Guard without permission from the federal government. And they didn't get it. And so there's going to be an interesting investigation into whether or not there was any, you know, sort of premeditation to delay the access to the National Guard to protect the Capitol or to put an end to the looting. And that, too, would be evidence that's usable in determining whether somebody has criminal liability.
Yeah, and I think that is fair. I think let's do one more question from our listeners, Betty. I know we've been going for quite some time.
I know. Okay. Thank you, everybody, for your questions. And I apologize if I didn't get to yours. And remember, you can also ask Michael at Michael Zeldin. So do you think a law getting rid of the Justice Department's memo saying a sitting president can't be indicted would help prevent Trump's type of behavior in the future?
Hopefully there won't be another Donald Trump in our future. But I think the truth of the matter is that suppose this happened 2 years ago. So Trump has 2 more years to be in office, and it's clear that he incited a riot and that he's liable under the criminal laws of the United States. And it's a clear-cut case that he incited it, and he used the magic words, and it was close enough in time that it met the imminent test. And so here it is, a clear criminal case to bring against him, and he's got 2 more years in the office. And then there's this Office of Legal Counsel memo that says a sitting president can't be indicted. Well, that's not law. That's just an advisory memo from the Office of Legal Counsel, which is sort of the think tank at the Justice Department, to the Attorney General, advising the Attorney General on what they think the lawfulness of that is. A prosecutor, theoretically, could say, you know what? I don't believe that memo to be correct, and I'm going to indict him anyway. And then he can try to, you know, interpose the defense of you can't indict a sitting president. Then we'll battle that out in the courts. But again, like with the Nixon pardon by Ford, this question of whether you can indict a sitting president has never been litigated. And so it's a theory, but it's not been enshrined in law by the Supreme Court. And so, you know, it would exist as a possibility under the right circumstances.
Well, yeah, let me say a couple things about it. First of all, Michael, I agree with what you said. This is essentially a policy of the Justice Department. And it doesn't really shouldn't surprise you that administrations in both parties take the view that a sitting president can't be indicted, because the Justice Department is representing the president and that administration. That's why you see that in two different presidencies, from different parties reaching that conclusion. Now, a state prosecutor isn't bound by that, but federal prosecutors are supposed to follow DOJ policy. That can be a problem for them if they do not. They are supposed to be following that guidance. And I do see and understand the desire to overturn that. But I think the original question was whether a law could be passed to overturn it. And I'm not sure such a law would be constitutional. That would have to be litigated, whether or not a law, a statute could constrain the charge, the constitutional authority or lack thereof of the Justice Department. In other words, even if a law said you can charge a sitting president and DOJ went ahead and charged the president, unlikely as that may be, given that attorney generals are appointed by the president, then you'd have a situation where a Supreme Court could say, no, you're wrong. Sitting presidents can't be indicted. And then that would invalidate that statute. So that, I don't think that statute entirely gets us out of the problem, but it might, it certainly is one way of dealing with it.
Right. But under both scenarios, yours and mine, and I agree with you, all they do is they create a mechanism by which the theory that a sitting president can't be indicted is challenged in court.
Exactly right. Well, Michael, I will tell you, this has been not easy. Thank you for fielding all these questions. You were so prepared and had so many thoughts to share. Thank you, by the way, Patty. I don't usually thank you because you just do this all the time. But man, this is so much work this time, sifting through everything. It was amazing the work that you put into organizing all of these. I hope, listeners, that we got your questions. I will do my best for the patrons to answer other ones in the groups and so forth. But thank you, Michael. Thank you for volunteering to do this. I'm sure we'll have more questions for you in the future.
Right. And what we should do is mark a spot on our calendar somewhere in February. if Trump doesn't resign, if there isn't. So the way this is going to play out is there's a hope that Trump will resign. Odds against that, pretty strong. The 25th Amendment forces him out. Really not a very realistic scenario. First, you have to get Mike Pence, and then he has a right to contest, and there's 4 days that, he still gets to be acting president while they debate whether he's suited for the presidency, and then his presidency is over. And then there's this question of impeachment. And the last thing I wanted to say, Renato, is that your listeners should be aware of is that there is a constitutional disagreement about whether a former president can be impeached. When you think of a impeachment as something which removes the person from their office, and that's sort of normal. So when you ask the question, well, then how is it they're going to impeach him and convict him in the Senate and remove him when he's no longer president? And the theory here is that in the Constitution, there are two things. There's one, the ability to convict and remove. And then there's a separate provision that says upon conviction, the Senate can vote to ban you from your right to run for future political office. You're essentially disqualified from future office. And so the theory is that a former elected official can be impeached after they leave office in order to give effect to that constitutional provision that prevents them from running for office again. Another thing that hasn't been tested in the courts. And that's why I say let's mark a place in the calendar. If he gets impeached and there's going to be a trial in the Senate of a former president, we have to figure out whether or not what defenses and rights will apply. And that'll be spectacular legal conversation.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. Well, thanks again, Michael. Thank you, Patty.
Thank you. It was an extraordinary conversation. Thank you both.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of On Topic. Please subscribe to this podcast, go to your app and review the podcast, and join us for our next episode. I'm Renato Mariotti. Until next time, let's stay on topic.